A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's asking about the evolution of automotive safety systems, specifically anti-lock brakes and emergency traction control, and where things are headed. And honestly, the timing's right, because the gap between what's possible and what's actually on the road has never been wider. The 2026 Mercedes EQS just avoided a crash. The driver never even saw coming, using a system that traces its lineage straight back to a 1978 S-Class and a mechanical valve that cost $3,000 in today's money.
The numbers tell you exactly why this matters. NHTSA data from the first quarter of this year shows a 14% drop in rear-end collisions for vehicles with Level 2 Plus predictive safety, but only 23% of the U.S. fleet has it. So we've got this weird moment where the technology to prevent most crashes exists, but most people aren't driving cars that have it.
That near miss in the EQS didn't happen by accident. It's the result of 48 years of engineering evolution, and it starts with a system that most drivers don't even know they're using.
Anti-lock brakes. Which is funny because IBS is one of those things where the light comes on your dashboard and you go, oh, something's wrong, and you pull over and it turns out you just hit a patch of gravel and the system did exactly what it was supposed to do. And now we're in the predictive electronic era, sensor fusion, vehicle-to-everything, communication, over-the-air updates that make the car safer while it sits in your driveway.
Survive the crash, to avoid the crash, to predict the crash. That's the arc. And the bridge between Era 1 and Era 2 was a system that could pump brakes faster than any human ever could.
And the predictive era, where the car anticipates the skid before you even turn the wheel. And the stakes are enormous. In 2024, 40,990 people died on U.S. roads.
Lay it out for me. What's the actual mechanical problem that ABS solves?
Okay, so think about what happens when you slam on the brakes in a panic stop. Without ABS, the wheels lock up. The tire stops rotating and just skids across the pavement. Two bad things happen immediately. Let's go back to the beginning. To understand where predictive safety is going, you need to understand the physics problem that ABS solved and why it took so long to get right. Two, on most surfaces, except maybe deep gravel, a locked wheel actually produces less braking force than a wheel that's right at the edge of locking up.
Why is that? Intuition says maximum friction equals maximum stopping power.
Three hydraulic valves, wheel speed sensors on only two wheels, and a microprocessor with 2 kilobytes of ROM. That's less memory than the text of a single email. The peak braking force happens at somewhere around 10 to 20% slip. The wheel is turning slightly slower than the car's speed, but it's not locked. IBS tries to keep every wheel right in that sweet spot.
It's not just about steering. It's about actually stopping shorter.
When a wheel locks up under braking, you go from static friction to kinetic friction. Static friction is when the tire is still rotating, still gripping the road. Kinetic friction is when it's sliding, rubber melting, smoke everywhere. And the coefficient of kinetic friction is lower than static friction. So a locked wheel actually provides less stopping force.
Which is counterintuitive. Most people think slamming the brakes and locking everything up is maximum braking.
Right, and that's the first big misconception. IBS doesn't always shorten stopping distance. On loose gravel or snow, IBS can actually increase stopping distance by 20 to 30%.
Okay, so walk me through the actual mechanism. How does a 1978 Bosch system pump brakes faster than a human?
The first production ABS was Bosch's system on the 1978 Mercedes, Benz S-Class, the WN16. It was a two-channel system. It controlled the front wheels individually, but the rear wheels together as a pair. And the physics of how IBS does this is elegant. There's something called the slip ratio. It's the difference between the vehicle speed and the wheel speed, divided by the vehicle speed. 0% slip means the wheel is rolling freely. 100% slip means it's locked. The sweet spot for maximum braking force is between 8 and 15% slip. That's where you get peak friction from the tire.
IBS is trying to keep the wheel in this tiny 8-15% window.
Right, and the original Bosch system did what's called bang-bang control. The valve has three positions: build pressure, hold pressure, release pressure. When the wheel starts to lock, it releases. When it starts rolling again, it builds. Release, build, release, build. And you feel that pulsing in the brake pedal, that's the valve cycling. Modern systems do continuous modulation. The 2026 standard is a 12-sensor suite feeding a 400Hz control loop.
That split mu surface. One wheel on ice, one on dry. That's where things get interesting, right?
This is the hidden complexity most people never think about. If you brake hard with one wheel on ice and one on dry pavement, the braking forces are wildly asymmetric. The car wants to spin toward the side with more grip. That's just ABS. The next step was emergency traction control, which uses the same hardware but solves a different problem. ABS prevents lockup during braking. Traction control prevents wheel spin during acceleration. The physics is similar. You want the wheel at that 8 to 15% slip ratio, but now you're applying power instead of braking. The first production traction control system was the 1987 Mercedes 4MATIC, and the way it worked was clever.
IBS bleeds into stability control. The lines start blurring.
Both of those reduce power to the spinning wheel without the driver lifting off the accelerator. Instead of releasing brake pressure on a wheel that's locking up under braking, it applies brake pressure, or cuts engine torque, to a wheel that's spinning under acceleration.
If I'm on ice and I floor it, one wheel spins uselessly while the other sits there.
If the left wheel is spinning on ice and the right wheel has grip, the system brakes the spinning wheel. That sends torque through the differential to the wheel with grip. It's like an electronic limited slip differential, but using the brake calipers instead of mechanical clutches. It's an electronic limited slip differential, essentially.
That's clever. Using the brake as a torque routing device.
It's fast. The first car in the U.S. with standard ABS and traction control was the 1989 Ford Thunderbird Super Coupe, but the real synthesis came with electronic stability control. Yaw is rotation around the vertical axis. If your car is spinning like a top, that's yaw. The yaw rate sensor measures how fast the car is rotating, and the computer compares that to what the driver is asking for based on the steering angle.
Now the car knows where you're pointing the wheel and where the car is actually going.
Those are two different things when you're losing control. The yaw rate sensor is typically a tiny vibrating structure gyroscope. It measures the car's rotation around its vertical axis. ESP solves the fishtail by braking individual wheels. During oversteer, it brakes the outside front wheel. That creates a counter-rotating force that pulls the car back into line. During understeer, it brakes the inside rear wheel to help rotate the car into the turn. All of this happens in milliseconds, before the driver even registers that they're losing control. Left front brake to catch oversteer, right rear to catch understeer. The specifics depend on the situation, but the principle is, use asymmetric braking to create a correcting torque.
This is the system that became mandatory.
A compact family car from Mercedes, the company that invented the crumple zone, rolled over in a maneuver that other cars handled fine. The NHTSA started pushing for a mandate in 2004, and by 2012, ESC was required on all new passenger vehicles in the U.S. A 2006 NHTSA study found ESC reduces single vehicle crash risk by 49% and rollover risk by 80%. Mercedes recalled 130,000 cars and retrofitted ESP, and that single event accelerated stability control adoption by years. Every manufacturer looked at that headline and thought, that could be us.
49% reduction in single vehicle crashes. That's not a marginal improvement. That's a different category of safety.
It works because it addresses the root cause. Single vehicle crashes are usually loss of control events. The driver enters a corner too fast or swerves to avoid something, and the car exceeds its handling limits. The 2023 IIHS study showed vehicles with ESC have 49% fewer single vehicle crash fatalities overall. The physics is settled. The question is deployment. A human driver doesn't notice the slide until it's already significant, and by then the correction needs to be much larger. And often, it's too late.
That 100-millisecond window keeps coming up. The car's reaction time versus the human's. It's the thread that connects all of these systems.
But the real revolution is what happens when the car can see the road surface before the tires touch it.
How does a car see black ice?
This is where sensor fusion gets interesting. Modern predictive systems use cameras and radar to scan the road surface ahead. Mobileye's IQ6 system on chip, launched in 2025, packs 176 trillion operations per second on a 5-nanometer process. It processes 12 camera inputs simultaneously.
Sensor fusion being the same Kalman filter techniques that keep your phone's GPS accurate, just applied to a much harder problem.
Same mathematical foundation, vastly more complex implementation. Each sensor type has different strengths. Cameras are great at classification. Is that a pedestrian or a mailbox? But terrible at ranging in bad weather. It's not just cameras. The Arbe Robotics 4D imaging radar, which went into production in 2024, can detect the height, speed, and position of objects at 300 meters. It can see through fog and rain in ways cameras can't. And then there's LiDAR. The 2026 Volvo EX90 uses a Luminar Iris LiDAR that can detect a tire on the road 150 meters ahead in complete darkness.
You've got cameras for texture, radar for distance and weather penetration, LiDAR for precision. And then what?
The EX90's core computing stack is an NVIDIA DRIVE Orin system, on-chip processing 250 trillion operations per second. It fuses data from 5 radars, 8 cameras, 16 ultrasonic sensors, and the LiDAR. The control loop runs at 50 Hz for planning, 500 Hz for actuation, so the car is deciding what to do 20 times a second and executing it 500 times a second. But some bounces off the road, off nearby cars, off buildings, and those multipath reflections carry information about objects that are occluded, hidden behind other vehicles. It pre-charges the brakes. Normally, there's a small gap between the brake pad and the rotor, a fraction of a millimeter, to prevent drag. When you hit the pedal, the hydraulic system has to close that gap before braking starts. That takes about 200 milliseconds. If the car sees ice ahead, it closes that gap in advance. So when the system needs to modulate braking, the response is instantaneous.
The car is braking for a child you haven't seen yet. That's not a hypothetical.
It's in production. And that's just onboard sensing. Add vehicle to everything communication and it gets even more interesting. Tesla's 2025 road surface estimation system takes this even further. It uses neural networks trained on 10 million miles of fleet data to predict the coefficient of friction in real time. The Greek letter mu, for the engineers listening, dry asphalt has a mu of about 0.8, wet asphalt 0.6, snow 0.2, black ice 0.1 or lower. The system estimates mu continuously and adjusts torque vectoring before the driver feels any slip. The latency is under 10 milliseconds.
That's faster than a human nerve impulse.
A human takes about 250 milliseconds to react to a visual stimulus, so the car is reacting 25 times faster than you are. But here's the thing, all of this capability exists. The bottleneck isn't the technology. It's cost, regulation, and edge cases.
Let's talk about the edge cases first. What still fools these systems?
The long tail problem. The 2025 Waymo open dataset shows that 0.3% of driving scenarios account for 60% of disengagements. These are corner cases. Deer at night where the animal's fur doesn't reflect radar well and the visual signature is confusing. Construction zones with temporary lane markings that contradict the permanent ones the map data expects. Vehicles with unusual shapes. A bicycle with a trailer looks nothing like what the training data expects. The neural network weights were retrained on more data, validated, and pushed to the fleet.
22% is a meaningful number. That's lives.
A false positive at highway speed can cause a rear-end collision. So you've got this tension. If you make the system too sensitive, you get phantom braking. If you make it too conservative, you miss real hazards. Actually less safe, because components wear. Now you can buy a car, and 6 months later it's better at avoiding accidents than when you drove it off the lot.
Which also means the regulatory framework has to adapt. You can't crash test a car once and certify it for life if the software changes every quarter.
All new passenger cars sold in the EU must have AEB that works up to 60 kilometers per hour for vehicles and 45 kilometers per hour for pedestrians. NHTSA's FMVSS 27 mandates AEB for passenger cars in the U.S., but not until 2029. So there's a 5-year gap where U.S. market cars can ship with less aggressive calibration. A drowsy driver makes characteristic micro-corrections that are different from an alert driver's inputs.
The steering wheel has a biometric sensor. That's clever because it works even if you're wearing sunglasses or a face mask.
But the result is that two identical-looking cars can have very different safety performance depending on where they were sold. Two interior cameras tracking eye gaze and head position, combined with capacitive sensors in the steering wheel. It knows if your hands are on the wheel and where you're looking, which leads to one of the practical takeaways. When you're buying a used car, look for electronic stability control as a non-negotiable feature. NHTSA data shows ESC reduces fatal single-vehicle crash risk by 56%.
The EU has been ahead on some of this. They passed the General Safety Regulation in 2024, right?
Yes, mandating intelligent speed assistance, driver drowsiness detection, and advanced emergency braking for all new vehicles. Sensor count matters less than sensor fusion and control logic. A 2020 car with well-tuned ESC can outperform a 2026 car with poorly calibrated predictive systems. Calibration is the bottleneck. Every car model has its own weight distribution, suspension geometry, tire characteristics. The control algorithms have to be tuned for each specific vehicle, and that tuning takes engineering time and real-world testing.
That tension between safety and driver autonomy is the uncomfortable part of all this. At what point does the car refuse to let you make a mistake?
It's already happening in subtle ways. ESC doesn't ask permission, it intervenes. AEB doesn't ask permission, it brakes. There's another misconception worth busting. Traction control and stability control are not the same thing. Traction control prevents wheel spin during acceleration. Stability control prevents loss of control during cornering. They share hardware, the ABS pump and the wheel speed sensors, but they solve different physics problems. And early stability control systems had this problem where they would fight the driver.
That's a big deal. The manufacturer accepting liability.
It changes the entire incentive structure. Once the manufacturer is on the hook, they have every reason to make the system as conservative and safe as possible, which might mean the car refuses to do things a human driver would attempt.
With all this technology in the car, what should a person actually do as a driver? Let's get practical.
If the driver is countersteering rapidly, the system assumes they're in control and backs off. If the steering is slow or absent, the system assumes the driver hasn't noticed the slide and intervenes. AEB became increasingly common after 2020, but it's not universal yet. Check the specific vehicle. These two features are the highest impact safety additions after seatbelts. That brings us to the next frontier, vehicle-to-everything communication. There's a pilot running right now in Detroit, 1,200 intersections broadcasting signal phase and timing data, SPAT they call it. The intersection tells your car when the light is going to change. Your car can pre-charge the brakes and adjust speed 500 milliseconds before you see the light turn yellow. The car is a safety multiplier, not a safety guarantee. I've seen drivers get overconfident in winter conditions because their SUV has all-wheel drive and traction control and stability control. None of that helps you stop on ice. None of it.
The all-wheel drive overconfidence problem. People think it helps them stop.
The car gets a digital feed of every equipped intersection state. And the next step is vehicle to vehicle. Your car knows the car. Three cars ahead is braking hard before you can see its brake lights. Check your manufacturer's recall and update portal quarterly. If your car doesn't support OTA updates, check for technical service bulletins related to safety systems when you get it serviced. That's where things get really interesting, because once cars are sharing data, you can do things that no single sensor suite can do. Imagine a car that hits a patch of black ice. Its stability control activates. It immediately broadcasts a warning.
The software-defined car means maintenance isn't just mechanical anymore.
The average driver has no framework for thinking about that. We're trained to check tire pressure and change the oil. Nobody trained us to check if our automatic emergency braking algorithm is current.
Let's pull back for a minute. All these systems. IBS, traction control, ESC, AEB, V2X, driver monitoring. They're all converging towards something. What's the destination?
It uses rear-facing radar to detect a car approaching from behind at 30 miles an hour faster than you're traveling, and it steers the I-7 within its lane to create space. It doesn't just warn you, it moves the car. A human is still better at interpreting ambiguous situations. Is that plastic bag blowing across the road something I need to avoid, or can I drive through it? The 2026 Ford BlueCruise 1.4 update added predictive speed assist. It uses map data to slow the car for highway curbs before the driver even lifts off the accelerator.
The next frontier isn't better sensors, it's better decision-making.
The ethical dilemma that engineers are grappling with right now, how does the car choose between hitting a pedestrian and swerving into oncoming traffic? That's not a sensor problem. That raises the uncomfortable question. Will predictive safety systems ever eliminate crashes entirely? The answer is no. The long tail of edge cases means we'll always have some crashes, but the rate can drop by 90%.
The trolley problem, but it's 60 miles an hour with 100 milliseconds to decide.
The uncomfortable truth is that there's no consensus on the right answer. Different cultures have different preferences. A famous study, the Moral Machine Experiment from MIT, found that people in different countries have systematically different preferences about who to protect in unavoidable crash scenarios. Should the car prioritize its occupants? There's another dimension to this, over-the-air updates. The next 5 years will see a shift from safety as hardware to safety as software.
Which means the engineers are making ethical choices and encoding them in software, whether they want to acknowledge that or not.
Every line of code in the decision module is an ethical choice. Brake force allocation in multi-target scenarios. That's a dry engineering term for who gets hit and how hard. The industry is uncomfortable talking about it, but it's inescapable.
There's a deeper question here, one that I think gets less attention. As cars become safer, do drivers become more reckless?
Others are still figuring out how to update the infotainment system without bricking the car. It's a real differentiator. The net safety improvement is still positive. You're better off with the systems than without, but it's not as large as the engineering numbers alone would predict.
There's a safety ceiling we can't cross without full autonomy. Because as long as a human is in the loop, the human will adapt to the safety margin and consume some of it.
The car gets better at avoiding crashes, so the driver pays less attention, which creates new risks that the car isn't designed to handle. If ESC reduces crash risk by 49% in isolation, but drivers adapt and give back 10% of that through riskier behavior, you're still at a 39% net reduction. That's still enormous. This is why the 2027 EU General Safety Regulation is going to mandate driver drowsiness and attention warning systems. Cameras inside the car watching your eyes, tracking your head position, detecting if you're looking at your phone.
It also depends on the type of safety system. Some interventions are invisible to the driver. You might not notice the car applying individual brakes to correct a minor slide. Others are very noticeable. AEB slamming the brakes on is hard to miss, which is a weird inversion. We spent decades making cars that protect you when you crash. Then we made cars that prevent you from crashing. Now we're making cars that prevent you from checking out while the car prevents you from crashing.
If you're an engineer or a developer listening to this, the biggest unsolved problem in automotive safety right now is the edge case dataset. We need better labeled data for rare scenarios.
What's coming in the next model year or two that pushes this further?
And it's an area where open source contributions can actually move the needle. These are systems that use V2X and cloud data to reroute the car away from high-risk intersections before the driver even approaches them. The weird stuff is where the fatalities happen. The routine highway driving the systems handle fine. It's the edge cases that kill people. The Moose test, literally and figuratively. You never know there was a risk. You just take a slightly different route home.
The question is whether we can deploy it fast enough, and whether we can keep drivers engaged while we do.
One more practical note before we wrap. Understand the limitations of your car's safety systems. Read the owner's manual section on limitations. Some AEB systems don't work above 50 miles an hour. Some don't detect pedestrians at night. Some can't see bicycles. Knowing what your car can't do is just as important as knowing what it can. You get out and think, nice drive.
Three near misses you never knew about. That's where we're heading, and it's weird, wonderful, and a little unsettling.
The unsettling part is the loss of agency. We're not used to machines making life and death decisions on our behalf without our awareness or consent, but we're also not very good at making those decisions ourselves. The data is clear on that.
4,000 meters of brass messenger weights and glass bottles in the roughest water on Earth. What could go wrong?
In the 1930s, British geographer Frederick Bailey described the tidal bore on Nepal's Kosi River as a mascarette, a term borrowed from French that originally referred to the tidal surge on the Seine, derived from an old Occitan word meaning stained or soiled, because the advancing wave churns up mud and turns the water brown.
But the deeper question is whether we're building a system where the human is the backup, not the operator, and whether that's a transition we're ready for.
The 1978 ABS system cost $3,000 and saved lives by keeping wheels turning. The 2026 Predictive Safety Suite costs $8,000 and saves lives by seeing the future. The technology works. The physics is settled.
The safest car is the one that never gets into a situation where safety systems are needed. We're building cars that can see around corners, talk to traffic lights, and make ethical choices in milliseconds. This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumintop. If this episode gave you a new way to think about what your car is actually doing when you drive, share it with someone who thinks their 2015 car is safe enough. It's protecting you from yourself. And that's a different relationship entirely.
Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumintop. This has been My Weird Prompts, episode 2001. Find us at My Weird Prompts.
If you found this useful, leave us a review wherever you listen. It helps more than you'd think.
See you next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long ear host. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.